Down to Auburn, beginning a visit with Rick and Debbie this Friday after supper, the 1st of December, 72. Channel 2 Auburn, beginning the visit with Rick and Debbie this Friday after supper, the 1st of December, 72. Channel 2 Auburn, beginning the visit with Rick and Debbie this Friday after supper, the 1st of December, 72.
The next day I was with him, he looked at it and he said, no, I've never seen this kind. So he opens it up, you know, and he puts his finger in it, tastes it, puts his finger in it, tastes it again, not too bad. And then he goes, that's so corny.
The rhubarb.
Yeah, where's the rhubarb?
It's right here.
What? Getting ready for your call.
That's a big dinner.
Yeah, I'm drinking cold coffee. Everybody else drinking hot.
Here's your coffee.
That what's up? Where you come from?
Well,
you think you got a cohort?
Yeah, in fact, I think we got somebody to work for us.
Gee whiz, that's what I thought when we
after what I've seen, heard today, I'm afraid Shaw Grigsby is just a good way to kill an hour. Well, not even a good way, just well. Here I went.
I'll be right for you. Yeah, just because it's slow.
Went after, I thought I saw Dr. Moss yesterday. Well, I didn't. Saw some other doctor, but I believe when I left his office, I said, thank you, Dr. Moss. And so today, and they showed me in, they showed me to a different office, and I said, no, I wasn't here yesterday. I was over there. He said, oh, that's Dr. So-and-so. I said, well, is he in? He said, no, Dr. Moss is. I said, okay, I'll see him. And he is an English professor who's got half time off to work in the Humanities Council Development Agency, and he knows you, and he knows about your work, and he's been waiting for somebody to come in and ask him to help get some money up to help you out.
Well, I'm telling you, he's one of the nicest fellas I ever saw. He's a young fella.
Right.
And how in the hell he got in the 18th century, I don't know. I just told him, and he's got one of his money for peculiar subjects. He's got some sort of court comedy. I don't know what it is. I just made that up. In the early 17th century, a man like that, why, he could run for the city council. I mean, couldn't he?
Oh, he looks the part, too. Great big brown eyes. Very scholarly looking. Very personable.
Very personable. He hears what you say?
That's right. He's the only one that I have ever handed a proposal to. Well, he was only one of the two today who just said, okay, I'll read through it and let you know. I said, you might have a little trouble with it. He says, okay, I'll tell you what I found out. Pulled out a sheet and stapled it to it and said, I'll treat this like a project and let you know next Friday. He's busy. Whew. He's just as busy as he can be. But he must have heard me for an hour. And Spivey was back there waiting. Oh, dear. So he gave me a list of people to run down. And I ended up talking to Clarence Derrick, who's head of humanities in comprehensive little hall. To find out where his daughter was working, And that was kind of a dead end. She's doing linguistic study in the Misuki, which is the Seminole language. But she can put me in touch with Sam Proctor and a guy named Wayne Johnson, who handles all the, just working with the tapes, all the copying and all the preserving.
That's who you want.
That's right. So she, I know how to get in touch with him now.
You want somebody, and I asked Sam Proctor.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I think he's just another.
He's impossible to catch. He's got three offices.
I don't think you catch much if you catch him.
But he works with a guy named Mann and a guy named Fairbanks. They're all three doctors, and they have that grant from the Duke Foundation to study the Seminoles. But
don't get too hot, honey.
I
won't. I'll open the door, turn on the fan, or turn it down. Would you tell me? I can't
tell. I'll tell you.
See, I got on my coat. But you tell me.
I will.
You have great bathing suit.
I'm not. I'm perfectly comfortable. Yeah.
They said call a museum and ask for oral history, and they'll hook you right up so I can get in touch with them.
Uh-huh.
And then I got in touch with, tried to get in touch with a guy named Steve Conroy, who works under, I've got it written down, Ron Foreman. They're over in Building D, and he's doing project dealing with segregation and the way it's being forgotten what it was to have black and white water fountains. And that's also, he's working with oral histories. He works in the African studies. They weren't in, so I didn't get to talk to him. So I went over to ASB and got a hold of Don Williams, who just finished a project of sorts where he took the word home and then studied public speeches given by black people of two types, ones that were for segregation, ones that were against it, and to see what the word meant. And those that were for segregation, I think he said home was kind of an alien thing. And those that were against segregation, wanted the integration, home was a living thing, a warm thing. Anyway, I talked to him about what we did out here, and he didn't ask a question. He probed around, and when I'd say, no, it's not linguistic, he'd say, oh, well, this is interesting. He was fascinated with it. So I let him look at it. Of course, I only had those two copies, and I said, I kind of need to hang on to those copies. He said, that's okay, we'll have them copied. And he answered their secretary, and she just stepped across the hall and ran through the copy machine and came back with it. All the remarkable facilities they've got. So he's got a copy of it. And he put me on to this Humanities Foundation that's being organized. It's federally sponsored. And the idea is to get interdisciplinary grants. And he said, right now there are not too many grants being given for individual work. They're hard to get. But when you have two or three disciplines working together, they're a lot easier. And Moss said that the more money you ask for, the easier it is to come by.
Yeah.
So he said Tuesday night there's a meeting, and that I ought to attend, and you too if you wanted, and just hang around with Moss, and he could just point out people to get in touch with, plus give me an idea of what's going on with this organization, because they've just started. I think it's going to be a third meeting.
This way.
Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, we've got some tapes, and that they could be used by linguists or sociologists, but of course we had our own purpose. And he said, I can see that. He said, but they can be worked out where nobody steps on anybody else, but all works out of one fund. I think Moss is the biggest gift, because he said right away, he knew that there was a problem and that it would be hard just to talk directly to you. He said, I know what's going to happen. He says, people who have any of the humanist tradition in them are usually about two dialects away from what most people talk. He said, the guy, I think he's about five away. So we got somebody up to bat now. And then I can track down. Williams was really interested. And, of course, can just point me out.
You know, it's shameful to leave those in there. And you cut off whenever you leave your room for very long, you cut the heat off. I always cut this off. I do it naturally. I mean, just basically.
Yeah, because that's what she's
going to do. You don't go off and leave a fire. And, but it's just reckless. Just mm-hmm. reckless to leave anything. You see, I've no wooden house in town or the country. Half time I come out here, I look over here to see if it's still here. That's
right.
True. See, there's soap. But once you get a spot, it's gone. $10. I've tried to. That's too warm on you. I've tried to. I don't know what to do. Think of somebody to put a concrete block thing in the basement or something out here. But I haven't been able to come up with anything. You know, it's so much trouble. That trouble is just so much trouble. I need to blow a little of that.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody's uncomfortable. You just think they are.
It's a little warm.
It's so troublesome. Now, the library has a place to put those things, but you see, I can't even get over there. I didn't know they had a new library. I can't get over there to find out, and I never get anywhere if I go over there to the library.
Makes a lot of difference when somebody will go along with you, then.
Yeah.
And of course, he just knows who to contact and what monies are available. And said his department doesn't have any money, but they know what it is and who to hook up with.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm. And see, neither he or Williams asked too much about proposals. It amazed me. He said, now, Williams is really sharp. He's very sharp. You may find that he's not interested at all. You may not get anywhere with him. Or he might be interested. And he just picked it up right away. Because I couldn't quite say what it was when he just accepted that.
I'll tell you. I've worked in that for several years now. The big statements and the abstractions. I mean, I've actually worked in it. I've used it myself, and then I've worked with students, and I've worked through a lot of books and all with that in mind. And you see, I don't know how it is that you're not bothered with that. Your statements never distort the saying. But I think the worst thing I ever saw was this, what's his name, Stoffer, Future Shock. He got some statements, each paragraph, he starts off, you see, with a violent statement. Then it's pretty violent all through the paragraph, the whole damn book. And they say, that the pollution people who are against it, they are alarmists. Well, it's not exactly that. It's that their statements are too strong, and they don't mean it that way. But that's all they know how to do. They can't give you the experience. All they can do is give you a statement. And that's where it stops there. Yeah. And, well, they do. It must be a fierce world they live in of all those abstractions. And, you see what it does to your neighbor out there.
Made him deaf.
Does it, is that all of his talk in the evenings?
He talks about the hunting camp. That's all he can talk about is going out in the hunting camp and watching the deer walk by. That, and once in a while he has a new business now. His business is organic insects, and they're always getting these boxes delivered to their house of praying mantis eggs, and they'll say on them, "Perishable, do not place in direct heat or in cold," and so Shaw leaves them out in the backyard where they get rained on, that kind of thing. And he always manages, well, he never finishes anything, doesn't finish anything. I told you about his tool shed that he started 10 years ago and still doesn't have a door on it.
I was battered last night. I couldn't hear.
Well, the backyard of their backyard is like Cookie's backyard, sort of. I mean, they have all these old cars and trucks that Shaw has picked up in the last 10 years and said he's going to remake, and they just sit there. There's a truck that's missing a wheel, and so it's kind of tilted on one side. And then there's the car that they lost the coral snake in.
The what?
The car that they lost the coral snake in at the homecoming parade. And that car's been sitting there longer than the truck. They caught a coral snake, and they put it in a mason jar, gave it to their kids to play with. And the kids wanted to take it to the homecoming parade. So they took it to the homecoming parade. And, of course, the kids opened the jar, and the coral snake got out into the car. And they couldn't find the coral snake, so they never drove the car again. They just put it in the backyard and left it there, and it's there now. It's sitting there. It's got old Christmas tree ornament boxes piled in the front seat, and it's been sitting there. And then there's another car that Shaw used to drive us to school. I used to go to school in a carpool with him. Shaw drove, and my father drove, and Bob Marcus drove across the street. And we used to go in that gray station wagon. But it finally just broke down, and it never would occur to Shaw to try to get rid of the car. It's still sitting there. So that's three. Two cars and a truck. Then he started a greenhouse, and the greenhouse is finished. The bottom part of it is just plastic. Every time he goes to South America, he works with the Peace Corps, I believe, in South America, something. And he's always going down to South America and living for months in the jungle. And that's sort of like going to the hunting camp and watching the deer walk by. And he comes back with all these exotic orchids, which he smuggles into the country because it's not legal to bring plants into the country. But he does anyway. He puts them in his pockets and he puts them in his briefcase. And this is being in society, right? He's bringing back all these illegal orchids for his wife, who puts them in this greenhouse. Well, they didn't have any place to keep them. They didn't have any place to keep these orchids. You can't just put orchids anywhere because they have to have heat. So he started building a greenhouse for Sigrid, but he never finished it. And the bottom of it is finished with plastic. You know, so at any time, a good frost is going to kill all the orchids. Then at one point, his daughter decided that she wanted a horse. And Shaw... Everything that he sets out to do things, and there's always just one little thing wrong. Like, he wanted to get his daughter Susan some cats, and what they got these purebred Siamese cats whose mother was a tiger cat. But they're purebred, don't you know? They still have that one of those cats around. And then Susan wanted to have a horse, and so Shaw took on this project because he figured that if he got Susan a horse, she wouldn't start going out on dates. And you know, that would just be awful if she went out on dates. And so he looked around to get her this horse. Looked and looked and looked, and I can remember, he came over one night and said, "We have a horse for Susan. that registered Tennessee walking horse, fine horse, just when you see it, it's a colt. Susan couldn't ride. It's a 9-month-old colt. She can bring it up herself. Registered Tennessee walking horse. It's just going to be wonderful. Susan's not going to go out with boys. The horse is blind in one eye. This filly had her eye kicked out, and that's why they got it for free or something, because it was a registered Tennessee walking horse. You know, he starts out just fine, but he ends up with a horse that had his eye kicked out. You know, I mean, that's just sort of the story of his life, is that he has these very grandiose plans, and they just don't quite make it. You know, they're not quite complete. They don't quite get there. Oh, and then they lay, I don't know, they laid a terrace in the backyard, and the day after they laid, after it was down, Shaw got somebody to do it that he knew, of course, so that they'd do it for half price or something, and we went over there the day after it had dried, and it rained, and there were all these big puddles in it, you know, it's a concrete slab, and the people that laid it, they were all these...
Just waving.
And Shaw said, you know, I don't think they leveled this there. Oh, dear.
Well, gee whiz, Debbie, he's one of your earliest recollections.
Yes. Yeah, he is. I used to ride to school with him every morning. He and Susie and Whipshaw.
Well, his hearing wasn't...
Well, nobody listened when they drove us to school. You could say anything you wanted. Nobody cared. But.
Then you all have visited all evening.
We've listened to Shaw talk all evening. I wouldn't call it visiting with him, because he doesn't like it too much when other people talk. When he talks, he gets going on hunting, and he just talks, you know. But it's not interesting to listen to him talk about hunting, about going to the hunting camp. He's interested in how good it is for you to go out and sit in the woods and get, you know, bitten by chiggers and things like that, that's healthy, that you should go and sit in the woods, and it does so much good because it's so quiet. He can't hear anyway. and then he's always talking about how many, it's illegal to shoot doe, isn't that it? Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to shoot doe, and so he usually manages to slip into the evening how many doe he's gotten, because they just walk right into where he's shooting. I mean, I don't know, maybe he just shoots into the woods and the doe just happens to be walking in front of the gun as he shoots, and he gets it that way. I don't know. But he's his son has taken up fishing now. His son is a bag boy at Publix.
Oh, he's promoted.
He's
following now.
Shaw?
His boy.
He's a cash register person now.
He's at a different store, too.
Yeah, what is it? He stopped?
He said he was chief stockman at Winn-Dixie. I guess he just picked
up
Winn-Dixie.
Oh, well, I didn't know that.
See, he's going right along.
He's paying for the big boat. He bought a boat, Little Shaw did. And he goes fishing all the time now, catches fish. Mm-hmm. I guess he's not as interested in hunting as his father is.
Well, his father was a big man over there.
Well, I had no idea Shaw was such a big man. I had no idea.
He advises all sorts of people.
I just thought he was just a little agricultural sociologist. That's what I thought he was.
He was the head of the sociology department there for a while.
I didn't know that.
And then they gave him a pretty big boost, and he went on over into the agriculture side. So he was in both sociology and agriculture, but now he's just in agriculture. And he's a full-time sociologist, and he's a professional programmer. And I said to the secretary when she said that, I said, "What does Professor Grigsby do?" She says, "He's a professional programmer." I says, "What is that?" She says, "Just wait a minute and I'll ask." So the other girl came on and she said she didn't know. She'd ask. But what a programmer is what he, Rick told you. Now, what is that expression, con the system?
Sean knows all the right words.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Con the system.
Right with it. Con the system, bring back his latest venture. His latest venture is two macaws, you know, the big parrots. They're red and they're beautiful birds, and he got them in South America. They're big, they're about this big. And he came over the first morning he brought them back from South America. We thought they were having a cat fight in the backyard because they when they scream, when they cry, they sound a lot like cats yowling. And we thought they were having a big cat fight, and later on in the day, Shaw came over and said that he had this new parrot that he brought back. This parrot, beautiful parrot, beautiful parrot. They live to be 100 years old. They train them to talk, train them to do anything. Of course, it has a broken wing. And it does. It has a wing like this. It's like the blind horse. It's exactly like the blind horse.
Yeah. Now, is he a linguist? He goes to South America where all those languages are spoken?
He lived 3 years in Germany where he met his wife, and he never learned to speak German in 3 years. Body told me that. See, his wife's father is who I visited in Germany.
Body.
Sigrid Grigsby's father is my friend in Germany.
Well, I'll be damned.
Isn't that something? I have a letter from him.
Isn't
he just sent me a letter today. I have a letter from him.
Well, go get it and see what it is.
You want to hear it?
Yeah.
It's after you hear it, I'll tell you where he learned to speak English.
Well, what do you know? What do you know? That's the one who showed her the castle?
Yeah.
All the picture angles.
That's Sigrid. That's right. That's the name.
That's his wife's father.
Yeah. Of course.
Well, I'm
Shaw Worthy, you see, just submitted to me, wrote a tell about. This is another my.
You know, the air comes in, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Darius going down to say tonight.
I hope we don't fall.
Foddy taught himself to speak English in a World War I French prison camp. He was in prison camp for 2 years, a year after the war ended, and to keep himself occupied for 2 years, he taught himself French and English. And then the only reason that he kept up with English is because his daughter married an American, so he has a chance to speak it. But, "Dear Debbie, don't be cross with me because I let you wait so long in answering your kind letter. I thank you so much for it. I got it in the last days of my stay in Gainesville. You can imagine that those last days were filled to the verge. We drove to the Jacksonville Fair still and went bathing to Alexander Springs with Sigrid and Shaw. My friend Otto Volchner took me for the last time to Crescent Beach for a wonderful surf bathing. There was a homecoming of PKY and so much writing to do that at the end I scarcely had time enough to pack my stuff. With all that, I wasn't even able to say goodbye to your parents who came home from London the night before I started. I have to apologize to them for it. It was a wonderful weather those last days, over 80 degrees. When you wrote about snowing in Boston, my flesh began to creep. It was just a signal to me to prepare myself for the winter in Germany. So when I came back, I was astonished to see the people in Brussels sitting in the cafes outside on the streets. It really was very mild weather over here. Just today we had our garden white with snow in the morning, first time, but the sun didn't like it and lapped it up by noon. Nevertheless, the difference of time, of weather, of food, of nearly everything in the way of life over here is always somewhat taking for an old boy like me. It takes some weeks to get used to the old rhythm. I think anyway I got it now. I was so sorry for you to hear you couldn't find a job in Boston. One should think that it would be easy to find a good job in a big city, but surely the conditions of labor and of the market of working are so much different over there than they are here. Though your mathematical work at Harvard was a good experience, I can imagine it was a hard one without special training. Now I suppose you to be back in Gainesville, and I sincerely hope you get a satisfying job. I think there were so many people to help you with it. Your parents will be glad to have you home again. I thank you, and so does Mrs. Craigman, that's the woman that he lives with, for so much for the nice pictures you sent us. We really enjoyed them. The picture of both of us in the garden, as well as that of Anya, their dog, belonged to the best ones we had. The pictures of the black, red, and white berries, to be sure, made Sigrid's mouth water. I gave them to her. I have to say thank you for her, too. Mrs. Craigman always enjoys the slides from little Julia. Julia is a big girl now, cute as ever. She has so much personality and always remembers me to Susan when she was a baby. Her brother just came back from the hospital. They made a big skin transplantation to his burned leg. The 2nd of November, Carl Hans brought home his wife from the sanatory in the Black Forest. She's completely well again. They are now living on the first floor of our house, as there are three other people living in the house still. Mrs. Craigman's nephew, a female chemistry student, and a female archivist. Archivist? Mm-hmm. Someone who works in archives? The house is like a guest house. My room, thank God, is the only oasis in it. I have to stay in it for 1 or 2 years still because there is no room available in the condominium I'm planning to go. As I feel very well at present, it's not hard to wait. So I guess you will meet me in Darmstadt when you come for another visit of Germany. What about your studying German? Did you start it yet? I hope you wouldn't think it's too hard to do it. It really requires a lot of energy and patience. Maybe I'll hear from you about it. Now, Debbie, have a good time. I'm wishing you a wonderful Christmas at home. Please say hello to your dear parents and to your dear sisters. I'm looking forward to seeing your parents in Darmstadt.
Gee whiz,
right? He's all in the family.
Yes. Yes. Now, how long have you known him? All the time?
Well, yes, pretty much. He comes almost every year and spends time with them. So I've known him. I didn't really get to know him very well until I went to stay with him in Germany. But I've known him off and on for 10 years, I guess.
Yeah.
He's known our family very well.
But you didn't know him very well
until I stayed with him in Germany.
Yeah.
In Darmstadt.
Well, now what appeal? I don't know how to say it. What is it about him that you are interested in?
Well, I love the way he wanted to make me love Germany.
Yes.
When I went to see him, and he just he did so many things. Every day, everything we did, he would say to me, I want you to have a good experience of Germany. I want you to have a good memory of Germany. You have to do this because you have to have a good memory of Germany. And he was so eager about it, and he was so...
Well, now, if you were to ask me, see what it is about the Germans I like, I wouldn't be able to tell you. But from living over there, I have a great feeling for them. I don't care hardly who they are. I just love to be with them. But I wouldn't know how to say what it is. The ones I knew were clean. I never knew any of them that weren't just plain. You see, I lived on iced potato soup out of the garden. That's one of the main things we had to eat all summer.
We ate out of the garden, too.
Yeah.
Friday grew more things in that garden.
Yeah.
It was just incredible.
Yeah.
It was a flower garden, and in between the flowers were rows of cabbages and carrots. And all the berries, I took pictures. So he had three different kinds of currants. I'd never even seen a currant bush, and he had red currants and white currants and black currants. And he had gooseberries, and he had raspberries, and he had strawberries, and he had... apple trees and pear trees, all just in the garden. And the garden was perhaps the size of the yard of this house. Not that big.
Now that's why she went over there to visit him for, to see his garden. But he wouldn't show her his garden. He wanted to show her the castle.
Yeah. I was going to help him garden one day, and he told me, no, I couldn't do it. He'd gone out and gotten all these plants. And, well, they had just come back from vacation. I wrote to him from Nice, and I asked him if I could come to see him for a few days. And he said he'd love to have me come, and I suggested a time. And he said he'd love to have me come, but they were going on holiday the whole month of June, and they would get back the 1st of July, and he'd rather that I didn't come so that he could work in the garden, get it ready for planting and everything that he wanted to do. And that was fine. So I wrote and said, it was fine. I'd come in the middle of the month. And then, as it turned out, they had a whole lot of people coming in, and he didn't get to work in the garden as much as he wanted to when I arrived in the middle of the month. And so I told him I'd be happy to work in the garden with him. I'd love to garden with him if he'd let me. He had all these wonderful tools. He had it looked like a wooden carrot to make the holes to plant the plants. I don't know what it didn't have a name.
A peg. That's what we used to plant tobacco with.
Well, he was planting endives with it. And he'd gotten all these plants, and he'd asked the woman for 20, and she'd given him 40. And they were dying. They were just dying because he couldn't plant them fast enough. And I said, please, I'll help you plant them. We'll get all 40 in. If I worked with you, we could finish. And he wouldn't hear of it. He wouldn't let me work. So I couldn't work in the garden with him. I'd have loved to have done. We went and saw the castles instead. And he had a kind of a tour that he takes everyone on when they come to see him in Darmstadt. And he has it planned out so well that he takes you to the right spot and tells you where to take the picture.
That is, I remember that.
Yeah. It's really...
So that's where the angles are the best.
That's where the angle's the best. And I was so dutiful. So good. I took
all
the pictures for him.
Well, now, you see, Faye, I don't know what it was. But you see, Debbie's, she doesn't have that damn focus I always had.
Well, I know.
It just cut out so much. I must have always had that confounded focus.
That's right.
You see, I can't even see the garden, and we lived out of it. And I know that it had iced potatoes, and I know they had dogberries, and I know we had, gooseberries, and I know we had cherry trees, because they made cherry pies, and I'd drink sweet milk with a cherry pie, and she just held her head. Afraid I'd get poisoned.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't know. You see, I just started off wrong. Isn't that awful? It's taken me all this time to get halfway straightened out. I sort of lame the way it is, especially to tell the story.
Well, but he just gave all of his attention
completely for 5 days, and I lived in the house because Karl Hans's wife was in a sanatorium, and so I stayed in the room upstairs that was empty. Their houses are so full in Germany. I guess they must really have not enough space for housing, but everybody has, a couple of boarders right in with the family and everything. Like, he describes the three different, the nephew and the student and the archivist, and it's just a running guest house all the time. And when I was there, they had a little grandchild there, it was Julia, two, and running around up and down the stairs and in and out with the watchdog. They all have a watchdog. That dog was... I wouldn't have a dog around that you couldn't trust. He wrote to me and he said, when you come, well, at first he didn't know whether he was going to be able to meet me or not. And so he said, when you come to our house, knock and ring, don't come in because we have a dog. And to me, having a dog, it just meant that they didn't want the dog to get out on the street.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing else. I probably would have just, had he not been with me, just gone right in and just tried not to let the dog get out. Well, it was a German Shepherd about big, and she's a watchdog, and they don't let anybody come into the garden until the dog's seen them and smelled them and everything. So Fadi met me at the train station and took me home, and the dog came running up, you know, and she didn't bark, and that's what's frightening about dogs that don't bark, that just stand and look at you.
Yeah.
If a dog doesn't bark, it's sort of like Flem Snopes without a voice. They're just evil incarnate.
Oh, yeah.
And I went in, and Fadi said, you know, let her smell you. And so I did. And then he said, now you walk to the house, and I'll come behind you, because we don't know what she might do. And I walked into the house and shut the door and didn't go out again all day. But after that, she knew me, and it was all right. She knew I lived there, and didn't make any difference. She was a really friendly, nice dog, but they all have dogs like that. Everybody has a fenced yard and a dog like that. Really something.
Well, I got to go and read some papers. I got to go to bed. Debbie, let me tell you. I went over and got those papers here right here. I wanted to look at them, but I had a little bit of time. And it's not in there what I thought was in there. No. You've got the horses in there, but you don't have the stallion. The stallion is...
I know. I knew he wasn't there. I didn't know what you were talking about the other night.
The flimsiest thing I ever saw, the way you got it in here. He can't come out because you talked about him. When you was on him out there, gee whiz. But let me tell you, that is very nice, that little thing, that little whole sequence there, things that's right. Very nice. His prose is nice and his hand is nice and all. But that other one, you see, you got a lame start on there. But you still got the lady in, and I'm proud to see her. Except you see here the lady comes to the door, and then you start off telling about the lady and that won't work. That's just pedestrian. The worst sort. I've never seen you do anything like that. See, I don't know how to do it, but that ain't the way.
That
poor little lady that I was so interested in. Look at what happened to her.
That's what happens when somebody didn't tell you to put her in.
Yeah. Now we don't have a thing for today. All you've got is this trip to town.
I did something this morning.
In here?
Yes, I put it in here just before dinner.
Oh, you did? Well, you didn't ring the bell. Oh, what is it?
It's about going, the only time in my life I went luxury class on the deck.
You were on the deck.
I was on the deck in Greece and with the Algerian dope smugglers too. Coming back from Corsica, we went on the deck. I always travel deck class. Always.
In Greece.
We started out going deck class then, and that's really fun because Greek dirts are the dirtiest boats in the world. They're so dirty, and to go on the deck on a Greek boat, you just come off black with dirt. They're so dirty. Steerage class is always, you know, in the back where behind the smokestack, and so the wind brings all the soot down on top of you, too. And then if you have to sleep on the deck all night, that's even more fun. We came back from Kos to Piraeus sleeping, well, the steerage class was two floors, and downstairs everybody was sick, so we went upstairs. There were about six of us upstairs sleeping on the deck, and it was a very rough night, and the boat was going like this, which was why everybody downstairs was sick. And we were upstairs, but there were no railings upstairs. We were lying down sleeping, and the boat was going like this. And we just went to sleep on the deck, and we could have just gone sliding right off into the water at any time. never occurred to us that we were in any kind of danger. But I went luxury class one time going deck.
Where was that other place? You came back from Corsica one day?
Steerage, mm-hmm, yeah. With the Algerian dove smugglers. But that time, that was with Russell. We went to get on the boat, and Russell said, "My God, they're all Algerian dope smugglers all around us," because it was all the Algerian laborers coming from Algiers to Marseille, and that's the only people that were in deck class besides Russell and me and a couple of wives and about six or seven little children and the dope smugglers. So they weren't dope smugglers, but Russell thought they were, and she was terrified to ride in steerage. But
who was she?
She was really scared.
Well, how did she get around New York if she's so scared?
Well, it was different, though, because these were Algerian dope smugglers, not Greenwich Village dope smugglers. I guess that was the difference. I don't know.
Did they look sort of surreptitious?
Oh, yes. Algerians always do, especially if you're anywhere where they speak French. They tell you that the Algerians are sneaky and... You know, French people just don't like Algerians.
You know, one of the scariest things I ever saw in my life was an Algerian on a donkey. And that look that he gave me, I've never forgotten. I had another look. This was right at the bottom, you see, of the Himalayas, where we used to go to the... What do they call it? The hump. And ask Sam. This is far as you can go. This little strip where they took off, planes took off. And they didn't even encourage the GIs to go out in that village. There weren't many GIs there. They just came in on one plane, went out on another. They wanted to stop. But somehow I got down on this. There, where the market was, and here was this big black fellow sitting in a little go-kart, it was saying. It looked like a box on four wheels, and somebody pulled it. And it was the look on his face that would give it to me. He looked at me without looking at me. And I thought to myself, I get National Geographic. But you know what? I guess, Lily, if you'd known him, he probably wouldn't have been so scary. But he was certainly scary, but then didn't like the Algerian on the donkey. You spend the night with them.
Mm-hmm. 50 of them.
Maybe
we should have been scared.
I don't know.
Gee, isn't that something?
They shook their heads when we got on, too. That we got on the boat, we were the first ones on the boat because we wanted to get a good spot. We thought we might have to really sleep on the deck, and we wanted to try to get inside somewhere. So we got on first, and we started up the escalator before they started the escalator. They hadn't started it, and I said, "Russell, we aren't supposed to go yet." And she said, "Well, we can walk up the escalator, can't we?" So we started walking up the escalator, and I think someone saw us, and they turned it on while we were walking on it. Went tripping up the escalator, and we got on and showed our tickets to the steward, and he said, "You're going fourth class steerage?" And I said, "Yes, which way is that?" And he just sort of went like, "These poor girls." And he just sort of shook his head and let us go. And a little later on, the Algerians started coming in too, and we just camped out in the corner, and Russell said, "Well, you can sleep from 9 to 10, and then I'll sleep from 10 to 11, and then you sleep, we'd alternate an hour apiece sleeping all night." She was convinced that we could not only do this, but this was the best way to protect our goods and chattels, was was to sleep for an hour and then wake up and sleep again and wake up. And it didn't work. We both just went to sleep. Along with everybody else. Nobody bothered us at all. But one time I did go in luxury on the deck. That was...
You see, if... I'll learn some of these things from that fellow you saw here. But I learned them too late to use them over there. This fellow that... you didn't tell
Carl.
Me about Carl, did you?
Not much.
This is my old army buddy. He called me from some island up here one morning by breakfast. Wondering if I'd gonna be here. I told him no, I wasn't gonna be here. I'd come down here unless he could spend 3 or 4 days. But he said he couldn't spend that much time this time, but he would consider coming by. Well, I said, don't consider it. So I went on off. And he showed up. He landed this little strip down here at Orange Lake. And he got the general's jeep and came on up here. Tell me about it, please.
Yeah, and a little red cougar where the inside is just stuffed to the brim with knapsacks and maps and aerial photographs and bridges. He stepped out with a beard covering most of his face, a long hair covering the rest, and a hat on, about like that, and a jacket, and about 10 cameras. And I walked over.
Hung on his belt?
Hung on his belt, stuck in his pocket, hung around his neck. And I said, can I help you? And he was just turning the car around, and we got to talking. He said, oh, yeah, so a guy and I are big buddies. We ran the 14th Air Force. And about that time, I was beginning to think, like, he owned the ranch, and I was his. I thought, this is remarkable. And he pulled out a pencil and a piece of paper, and he's just writing down everything I said. And then I got to wondering, somebody must be a corporate spy or something who's trying to find out what's going on here. Is he going to sabotage us or steal the tapes? And he said, well, how did you get into this? And I said, well, I studied, had a course with a guy, and come here. And I said, well, what's the guy doing? I said, well, he's studying the countryside. Oh, that's marvelous. That's just marvelous. I knew he'd get into something like that. And I thought, well, how do you know? I didn't say anything. You don't know what countryside means. And so I just went on. He said something about my background. I said, well, you see, I come from the city. I mean, my yard was just 75 feet by 150 feet. And he's right now 75 feet by 150 feet in my yard. I go, well, what is he doing? And he said, no, I know. And I said, well, what's your name? He said, well, they used to call me Ian. They don't call me Ian tomorrow. It's Kierk. Actually, that's a contraction, and then he just ran through this long Scottish name. And then he starts explaining the name. And you see the middle part of this name means surround. You see, I come from this island that's shaped like this, and he drew like a little isthmus. And then he said, now you see there's 4 crossroads in this island, and when the wind comes this way, it parks the boats here. And when it comes that way, it parks the boats over here. And you see the church is in the middle. Of course, the whole thing is surrounded by water, and you see that's where we get the whole continuity of the community. And it just worked it out beautifully. I looked at him and said, all that there. And then I got to thinking, somebody's pulling my leg. Well, I could never figure out, and he had this beautiful Scottish accent. And then told me he spent most of his life in China. He spoke all the dialects, and the people over there thought he was Chinese. And had taught some Chinese fellow, I wasn't sure if he said Chiang Kai-shek or who, how to speak English. And then started on to his war stories about how he and Guy had saved all of Asia from the Japanese by fouling up communication systems or something.
Oh.
That's right.
But as long as the Japanese never knew, it was okay. said they had people on the hillside just working the hand generators day and night so we couldn't send anything. We lost all our crystals. We said they never knew it. They never knew what frequency we were on. That's because we weren't on any frequency. And so I said, well, have you got anything I can treat? I said, well, yeah, come on in. So I brought him in, and I showed him the tape recorder, and I showed him the tape. And he saw the box there, all the names on it, said, Miss Bessie. Bessie. That's not Bessie. I've got some relative's name Bessie. I'll look that up. I just didn't have it hard to say it. No, Bessie was the name. I doubt you're related. So we went on back out to the car. And he took off his coat. And he had on a t-shirt, a shirt like this. He reached in, he pulled out just like a vest. Like a hunting vest. And it had a little round opening sewn on for where he could put bullets. Only he had ink pens and pencils. And he had one of every color and every kind available. He had pencils. He had big pens. He had fountain pens. He had the watercolor pens. He had colored pencils. He had mechanical pencils. And I kept trying to write down his name, and then I'd say, there, I didn't write down your phone number. I'd get another color and a different kind of pen, and I'd write that down. So he put that on, and he put on a flannel shirt, and he put on a jacket. Now, I was in a t-shirt, and I was sweating. And this was in the middle of something. It was hot. And he was on his way to Vancouver. He'd just come from somewhere in South America and just stopped off. And borrowed this car, and said, now, I've got this Mercedes-Benz. Next time you got in Brunswick, you just go ahead and tell me you want Carl's Kierke's Mercedes-Benz. You can just drive it all around. I thought, Brunswick. Right in Brunswick, Florida. And I must have been in Brunswick, Georgia. But that was just nothing. You know, next time I was in Brunswick. And he was on his way to Vancouver. I said, well, I'm sorry, guy's not here. If you could wait a little longer. He said, no, I've got 33 minutes. I'll just make it back. And to be in the air with 27 people, I've got to get him to Vancouver. But it's okay. I can be back after Thanksgiving. Let me see. I can land a helicopter right out there. Because I've got a fleet of about 27 aircraft, you see. And he just hopped in his car. Was gone.
And what about that one?
He was going to offer to fly out. Oh, he says, you know, you all enjoyed the day over there. We just fly over there and you can look around. It won't be about 5 hour trip. You don't have to worry about anything. We'll take care of it all. I've got the plane. He's going to fly a guy and I over there. Just let him spend the day, have lunch, come on back.
And that's who he's bonged on in China with, you see. And this is the professor that students think never got out of a lunch workshop. Rick said the only thing that you ought to do, guy, is just keep Carl around and take him to class just one time. And you'd have him all eating out of your hand.
It's incredible. It's simply unbelievable.
He'd come on down here for 2 days.
Now you see, everybody I knew in China, I knew through them. Two of my best friends, he knew, and passed me on. But I still have that focus, that brain. Well, some people have to be crazy and some don't.
I hear guys saying something. Carl, I don't want to go. I can't get out. I don't want to go. Just don't. I'm not going to that meeting. He was. Well, I should go to San Francisco. I'll just fly out there for this little hour meeting, you know. 14th.
He was such a. He wanted to take a picture of the place and of me, so he just to prove he'd been here. So he just picked up his camera and took a picture. He put it down. He grabs one over here. So this one takes colors. We better move over. Let's see, we'll get that chimney there in the background. Let's take a picture. And then he reaches in his pocket, pulls this little tiny camera. Takes a little nice slide. I'll take a picture of this. So I'm gonna try this one over here. Fish for that camera. And I'm sitting, you know, in the car, and I've got this old piece of muffler pipe in my hand, and I'm dirty, and an old blue jeans. And, oh, that's great, right there. Guys. Oh, that's a perfect picture. Don't take a picture. I didn't know if he had film in the camera or not. I rather doubt it.
That's where I learned that people who take pictures never see the pictures. If they actually expose the film, they never develop it. That's where I learned it. That was in 1943. And since then, I found it works out in almost every case. just don't expect anyone, after they take a picture, to see it.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if you wouldn't land out here in this pasture all the time. Now that he knows.
Yeah.
I don't know how he knew to get here.
No, he knows him, yeah. He called me one time, and I remember, and he said, now we have this meeting in Fulton Air Force in Washington, and I come get you. I said, Carl, I can't come up there. Hell, I haven't been on Lutch County in 10 years. How are you going to swallow his tongue?
Man who lives around the world all the time.
Now,
he said he'd been collecting records, kind of an archive, and had like letters from Aaron Burr's wife and original documents from George Washington, and just a host of old American materials, and had them all filed on 3x5 index cards, and then something like 3,000 square feet of library space. And then the whole thing burned. I don't know how much of that was a story and how much was true. But he went on, and I was beginning to think that, you know, he was next to founding the Library of Congress. What he'd done.
Yeah. Debbie, I don't know. Now, you see, you've got those nice things. I don't know how to handle them. All I know is that's the way he's done it. Well, I know a little more, but I mean. You don't want to you can't afford just to put in your going deck passage in first class. You can't afford to put that in all by itself when you got all these other things. Especially those Algerian dope smugglers, and you didn't talk to them, but you saw them, and they must have been scary. Especially in that particular
light,
but they were just common laborers, I think.
Well, I guess they were. I don't know. Maybe they were.
You were in better hands there than you would have been in a lot of other places.
Probably.
Yeah. In
first
class.
Probably, yeah. They look shifty, though.
Mm-hmm. Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Well, can you? Yeah.
Shifty and... Well, they were real dirty, all of them. You know? They all had just about all their earthly possessions with them in cardboard suitcases. And they were all moving to Marseille, and they all had a cardboard suitcase and big, heavy, hard shoes. And I think it was that there were so many of them. There'd only been just one or two, it wouldn't have seemed quite as formidable, but when there were 50 of them, and they all looked pretty much alike, you know, they're sort of uniformly dressed and uniformly suspicious looking. But